This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on Friday, the 24th of August, 2012. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on the programme, with news that the Republicans are eyeing up a return to the gold standard, we find out what the likelihood is that the American economy could one day be dealing in precious metals rather than paper. We'll find out what a mystery parcel in Norway that's lain unopened for 100 years contains. And we'll turn our eyes to Vietnam, where there are fears of an economic meltdown following the arrest this week of one of Vietnam's wealthiest businessmen.
Since his kind of quite dramatic fall from grace, obviously there's been quite a lot of panic in Vietnam. And over the last few days, depositors have been lining up to withdraw money from the Asia Commercial Bank, the bank that he founded.
I'll also be joined in studio by Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound. Rob, what will you be talking about?
Well, I'll be telling you about the bullet I took by taking myself to Brazil and the duality between the two big broadcasters and the battle between the telenovelas and the serious news.
Yippee, bring me a caipirinha in too, please. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. Heaps to pack in over the next hour here on Midori House, but first let's catch up with the latest headlines with Barney Burnham.
It's 5 a.m. in Wellington, 1900 hours in Vienna, 1800 hours at Midori House in London, 10 a.m. in Seattle. You're listening to Monocle 24. At least two people have been killed and eight others wounded in a shooting outside the Empire State Building in New York City. Eyewitnesses say a gunman began shooting indiscriminately shortly after 9 a.m. on Fifth Avenue. Police then killed the gunman, who's been named as 53-year-old Jeffrey Johnson. Officials say the shooting was connected to a workplace dispute in which Johnson had lost his job about a year ago. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
He killed one person and at least nine other people were shot, and some may have been shot accidentally by police officers who responded immediately, and while confronting the suspect and fatally shooting him, unfortunately, there may have been other victims as well. All of those are not seriously wounded, and there is no expectation that any of them will do anything other than recover quickly.
A Norwegian court has found Anders Behring Breivik was sane when he murdered 77 people in a gun and bomb massacre last year. He's been jailed for at least 21 years and faces the possibility of indefinite extensions to his sentence. The prosecution had requested that he should be found insane. Breivik said he targeted the ruling centre-left Labour Party for its support of Muslim immigration. He said he would accept a sane verdict, but derided a jail term as pathetic and said acquittal or execution were the only reasonable outcomes. Christina Bjelland, vice chair of the July the 22nd support group, is hoping that today's ruling will be a turning point, allowing survivors and families of victims to get on with their lives.
Grief in this situation has been very difficult, and also working with the traumas for those who survived and were affected has been very difficult with all the media attention, with the trial. So we hope that things will calm down now.
Troops and tanks have swept into a town near Damascus in an assault aimed at crushing opposition to President Bashar al-Assad. In the past 48 hours, artillery and helicopters have hammered the Sunni Muslim town of Daraya, killing 25 people and wounding 200, according to opposition sources. Meanwhile, more than 3,500 people fleeing the violence have entered Turkey over the past 24 hours, one of the highest daily refugee flows since the start of the uprising last year. The number of Syrian refugees now sheltering in Turkey stands at more than 78,000. Talks between the United Nations nuclear watchdog and Iran, aimed at resolving concerns about Tehran's atomic program, have broken up without agreement. The IAEA's chief inspector said the talks had been intensive, but important differences remained which had prevented agreement being reached. Iran's envoy said some progress had been made. A senior UN official said no further talks were scheduled. A four-year-old hippopotamus, which had been stuck in a swimming pool in South Africa for 4 days, has died. It entered the pool at a game reserve lodge in Limpopo province after being forced from its pod by dominant males. The pool was being drained so that the animal could be tranquilised and hoisted out by a crane. It was reported to be in some distress as the pool was being emptied and died before it could be sedated. Seven times Tour de France champion Lance Armstrong says he'll no longer fight doping charges by the US anti-doping agency, which said it would strip him of his titles and ban him from competitive cycling. Armstrong has never failed a doping test and has long denied that he used performance-enhancing drugs. In a statement posted on his website, he said there comes a point in every man's life when he has to say enough is enough. Buckingham Palace has announced that the Duke of Edinburgh will not be attending next Wednesday's Paralympics opening ceremony in London. The 91-year-old Duke is recovering from the bladder infection, which has just forced him to spend 5 nights in hospital. Earlier, the Paralympics cauldron was lit in Trafalgar Square using the flame kindled at the top of England's highest mountain, Scafell Pike, earlier this week. Next Tuesday, it will join flames kindled in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland at Stoke Mandeville, where the Paralympics began in 1948. Today, part of St Paul's Cathedral became a sporting venue as Great Britain's women's wheelchair basketball team showed off their skills. They'd been invited to inspire people to use their full potential and to welcome the Paralympics to the capital. Canon Michael Hampel said the cathedral was happy to celebrate the Paralympics movement, which was born in the UK.
We want to celebrate the fact that the Paralympics are happening here. We want to celebrate the fact that human potential is something which we all have and which we often allow obstacles to get in the way of. But of course the Paralympians don't. They ensure that the gifts that they've been given are used to their full potential, and there's a great message there for all of us.
And those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. The time is 21:06 in Moscow, 18:06 here in London, and 13:06 in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist ja Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
Shandai, Efrog Newydd, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, the legendary US cyclist Lance Armstrong has finally chosen to end his appeal against the charges of illegal doping that have pursued him since he finally retired from the sport in 2011. He faces the prospect of being stripped of his record-breaking 7 Tour de France titles and will be considered by many as a drugs cheat. He maintains that he's never used performance-enhancing drugs. But will this latest development permanently tarnish his image within and beyond his sport? And what of the work of his pioneering anti-cancer charity, Live Strong? Michelle Verroken, an international anti-doping expert, joins us on the line to tell us a little bit more about this infamous case. Now, Michelle, I'm hearing reports just in that he has indeed been stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles. But maybe we could rewind a little bit and you could just recap what this case is exactly about.
Well, this case really has been brought on the basis of interviews that the United States Anti-Doping Agency has undertaken and evidence that they have been given from a federal investigation into the involvement and the use of doping products by Lance Armstrong. Now, some of that evidence is hearsay evidence that has come from former teammates and sort of the cycling entourage, and as a consequence the federal investigation was dropped, but the anti-doping organization in the United States decided that they would charge him with the with offenses involving possession and trafficking, and there are a number of charges that they have laid before him. And it is really for any athlete, when they've got those charges, to rebut them, or they are confirmed as sanctionable. Now, Lance Armstrong has decided not to enter into any hearing with the United States Anti-Doping Agency. So by default, is deemed to have accepted those sanctions.
And tell me, Armstrong has said that he's tired of fighting this because the process is so one-sided and unfair of the USADA. What exactly does he mean by that? Is it impossible for him to actually refute it and be cleared?
Well, I think the main issue there would be that some of the evidence gathered from his former teammates has been gathered on the basis of plea bargaining, basically, that the United States Anti-Doping Agency has offered leniency in return for testimony. And I think Lance Armstrong's legal team's view is that, of course, he could never be given any fair hearing because, of course, the suggestion is that this is evidence that is not objective. So his view is that they have conducted, if you like, I haven't seen the words myself from his statement, a witch hunt, because the application of the sanctions is for what is alleged to be, you know, doping violations going back to 1998, you know, many years before the United States Anti-Doping Agency, you know, before they were even brought into being. So it's a very interesting case. I think it's unprecedented in the world of sport.
Absolutely. And Lance Armstrong himself is a titan in the world of sports. Obviously, he retired in 2011. But what does this do to his personal sort of brand image? We mentioned there also in the introduction about Live Strong, the charity that he started following his cancer. You know, does it sort of damage that beyond repair too?
Well, I think this is one of the most interesting questions. On the one hand, the argument by the United States Anti-Doping Agency would be that no one can hide from the due process of seeking out cheats in sport. So therefore, even somebody who is suggested to be, you know, a paragon of virtue and raising, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars for the fight against cancer, you know, their doping misdemeanors cannot be disregarded. But at the same time, I'm sure there will be a lot of people who believe that somebody who has themselves gone through cancer, been treated, has then fought back from it, could never have done such a thing. So this is really the start of a really long debate, I think. And the bigger question, I think, will be, whilst the United States Anti-Doping Agency has issued a series of sanctions involving stripping Lance of his Tour de France titles, they obviously don't have the jurisdiction to actually do that. They are expecting other organisations to recognise their sanction and to apply them by taking the titles away, by preventing him from taking part in the sport of triathlon, which is the sport he's now taken up, or any other sporting activity, by virtue of the fact that the sporting world has united behind one world anti-doping code. But as I understand it, of course, the first question is, well, what is the evidence that you're expecting us to accept? And so there will be, over the weeks and months, I'm sure, that evidence coming into the public domain, and people will have to make up their own minds about whether or not this is a tainted brand, whether or not there is sufficient evidence there. So it is quite an interesting legal situation.
Indeed, it's definitely not a black and white case. Michelle Verrocken, international anti-doping expert, thank you very much for joining us. It's 18:13 here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Yeah. In terms of financials, in times of financial strain and upheaval, it's perhaps understandable that people reminisce and look back at how things used to be done. One such example is the gold standard, which helped regulate the international monetary system. It worked superbly in the 19th century. So why on earth will the Republican Party establish a committee next week to investigate a return to the link between the dollar and gold? Well, joining me now to help answer this question and to try and explain the thinking behind this move is Dr. Barry Bosworth, Senior Fellow of Economic Studies at Brookings Institution. Thank you very much, Dr. Bosworth, for joining me. I wonder maybe if you could start by explaining what exactly is being proposed and how likely it is to lead to a return to anything resembling the old gold standard that people might be familiar with.
It's an objective of a minority group within the Republican Party in the United States. They raised it back in the years of Ronald Reagan. They would like to return to a gold standard mainly because they see this as a way to increase price stability by eliminating the discretion of the monetary authorities. It's come up again basically because of a candidate named Ron Paul in the United States at the presidential level. I think they will probably include a proposal to look at it in the Republican platform because they need to keep his group on board going forward.
Is this something that they've sort of agreed with in any sort of widespread way with Republicans, or is it still very much a minority?
Still very much a minority. I don't think it's going to go anywhere in practice. Ronald Reagan did convene such a group, but the group concluded it would be a bad idea to go back to the gold standard. I think this is similar to this. So I don't expect it to ever lead anything in terms of American policy in the future, even if Romney should win the election.
And, I mean, critics have come out in force saying that Romney and his colleagues must be economically illiterate to advocate this. And, I mean, that certainly seems to be the case. But is it fair? And, you know, what is their objective exactly about bringing this to the fore, even to the point where people are talking about it again?
The Republicans Party is a coalition of a lot of strange groups. And to keep them together up until you get the nomination, you often avoid trying to argue with them. And I think that's what happens with Romney. After he gets the nomination, he will just ignore the platform, pay no attention to it. And it's not going to be part of his campaign. But it does. It's sort of like the recent episode with this thing about rape and what constitutes rape in the United States. It's just, it paints the Republican Party as a coalition of stupidity, and it's kind of embarrassing to them. But I don't think it has a serious implication for policy.
No, indeed. It certainly seems very outdated. I mean, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the pitfalls of pegging currency to gold. And, I mean, does any country still do this or anything resembling this?
There have been countries that tried like a variant of it. Argentina didn't pick gold. Argentina picked the U.S. dollar about a decade or so ago, and they had a complete financial collapse when they couldn't hold it anymore. You could make an analogy that within the Eurozone, the problem of the individual countries is not dissimilar from a gold standard in that if they could figure out a way to devalue their currency of a specific country, like Greece, relative to the other Eurozone members, they could solve their problems. So it's a system of too great of a degree of rigidity. It can't handle, it's not flexible enough to meet the needs of a modern financial system. So I don't think anybody seriously advocates it.
No, indeed. What's your view on the future of gold itself? Do you think it will always be a refuge for investors seeking safety in turbulent times? Or might it ever reclaim its 19th century role as the center of the monetary system?
No, it is, I think. During periods of great uncertainty, people rush to gold. It was a lousy return for many years up until the financial crisis in 2008. It's been a great return for a while. Now it looks like it's turning around, going to be a bad return again for a while. So it's basically something that people go to in times of great fear. And it's a pretty good index, in fact, of the extent of fear in the world economy. It's just watch gold prices. When people get anxious, prices go up.
Indeed. Well, Dr. Barry Bosworth, Senior Fellow of Economic Studies at Brookings Institution, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. This is Connection by Elastica. That was Connection by Elastica, and it was actually picked by our next guest. He's come back from Brazil to Midori House. It's our culture editor, Robert Bound.
Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Rob.
Everyone likes a theme tune. Everyone needs a theme tune on this radio station.
I wanted to know if you picked it just because you liked it, or if you picked it because you're going to be maybe talking about Elastica in Brazil.
I wish I could make that connection, but I can't. So the connection would have to be that simply it's called Connection, I think. That's the best thing. That's a coverall.
It's very meta.
It's very meta.
Tell me, you have just spent the last week between Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro for part of our Lusophone-themed
issue,
next
November issue.
October issue.
I was getting very confused.
It's very confusing. But you were there for a story. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the story without giving too much away.
Yeah. So there's an interesting thing. I mean, Brazilian TV is obviously the powerhouse, the media powerhouse in sort of Lusophone media. A lot more Brazilians speak Portuguese than Portuguese speak Portuguese, or Angolans, or people from Mozambique speak Portuguese.
Yeah.
And it's obviously a huge thing. Brazilian TV was a monopoly for years, and Globo was the big company that sort of came out of the dictatorship, and there were lots of, you know, like all these countries, lots of very rich people make programs that very poor people watch, kind of thing. So I kind of wondered how that had changed, and how, you know, with Rio being the next city for the World Cup, the next city for the Olympics, and São Paulo being this kind of economic powerhouse and this political powerhouse in the country, kind of what the relationship was between those two cities, their media kind of outlet, their media landscape, and what's on the TV in this kind of fast building country with this kind of like fast building middle class. So that's what I went
very
to
interesting.
Do.
Very interesting. And I mean, we've spoken a few times on various programmes on Monocle 24 about the growing Brazilian middle class. But what was interesting, I was in Portugal myself this week, and speaking to so many Portuguese there who haven't left the country, which a lot of other young Portuguese have done, they said that their entire sort of sphere of knowledge about Brazil comes from the Brazilian telenovelas, which are so popular there.
Yeah.
And that they're noticing quite a big change in the last sort of 5 years over what the subject is, the kind of families that are being portrayed and things. Did you manage to get on set?
Yeah, well, I went to the sort of the telenovela du jour, which is called Avenida Brasil. And it is, I can't sort of overestimate, I don't think, the sort of monstrous, all-encompassing popularity of this TV show. 8 out of 10 people that watch the TV in Brazil in the hours that it's broadcast of watching Avenida Brasil, which is a sort of, I think it's a world record for the most watched TV program at any time. I mean, it's kind of like the moon landing would have been, it was kind of a bit of an anti-climax ratings-wise compared to this show.
Forget the opening ceremony. The royal wedding. I can see our Brazilian researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco,
he's through the
nodding
glass.
Vigorously. He's
exactly. I know, it's a good test when we have a Brazilian to sort of nod in the next room. And it's an amazing thing that kind of has a sort of rude mechanical storyline. They built this notorious Rio rubbish dump, that, you know, that huge one that's very famous, and it got closed down about 3 months ago. So they recreated this. Globo TV have recreated quite a large sort of rubbish dump on their huge set called Projac, which is just outside of Rio in Barra. And there's also, they've built a huge favela. They've built all these things that this takes place in. And there's a sort of like, there's a posh family who are the family of a footballer, or not posh, but wealthy family. And then they sort of interact with this kind of like the fallen family who lives in this favela.
Maybe love on the wrong side of the tracks comes into it.
There is definitely love on the wrong side of the tracks. It's sort of like there's sort of argument about whose baby's who. There's who should be living in whose house. There's all this kind of stuff. There's extreme passion. And the star of the show is the sort of the anti-heroine is this woman called Carminha. And she is, every time you kind of mention the name Carminha in any sort of like Brazilian party or anything, people stop and listen and want to know what you think. So she, the actress that plays this woman, I mean, is pretty much the most famous woman in Brazil right now. And it is amazing. We shot her, so which is quite a coup. So I shook Carminha's hand.
Amazing. And presumably when you were out there and doing this story and having access to this, then I'm guessing you might have gone for a drink in the evening once or twice.
Yes.
Telling people what you were working on. People must have been fascinated.
People were phenomenally, yeah, I know.
You're probably almost as big a celebrity as the people on the shows.
that's for different reasons. That depends what you do with your drinks after hours, I think.
They just knew you from the culture show with Robert Bound.
Exactly. With my own theme tune, which is Connection by Elastica, and it all comes full circle.
Oh, Robert, brilliant. And you've come back with presumably a sort of updated idea of what Brazil is about. I think it's probably been a few years since your last trip.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since I was last there. And it's nice to sort of, you go and you kind of do very general things. You're looking for a great record label, you're looking for a musician, or you're looking for this or that. So it's great to see it through a bit of more of a specific lens, the lens of TV. And we're also going to be looking at the news and about the sort of political, sort of how the politics of those two cities bear themselves out through the TV as well. So it's not all kind of glittery fingernails and kind of sort of dark romantic passion, courtesy of Carminha.
Carminha's dark passion. Yes. Tell me quickly, things are shaping up in Rio now that...
Well, sort of. There's still a hell of a lot of traffic. There's still a hell of a lot of work to be done. There's stuff being closed down as we speak to build the subway, the underground network, in time for the Olympics in 4 years' time. So there's a lot of stuff that's sort of starting to happen. You kind of feel like the needle's dipped in that, have been just kind of suddenly dropped in that Olympic groove. And that's sort of suddenly starting to happen. And our mutual friend who works for the mayor out there, kind of, you can tell that sort of things are sort of kind of like starting to fizz a little.
Suddenly the lens has been shifted very much, and where everybody was looking at London with sort of Rio slightly in the distance, now everybody is definitely
looking
at Rio.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, belts being tightened, I'm sure, left, right and centre. Well, Robert Bound, thank you very much. You didn't bring me in a Caipirinha. But you did bring me in a small beer. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll find out what is in this 100-year-old mystery package at a Norway museum. I can't wait for that. And we'll be looking at why Europe is drinking less coffee. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Hugo. At least two people have been killed and eight others wounded in a shooting outside the Empire State Building in New York City. A gunman began shooting indiscriminately shortly after 9 a.m. Police then killed him. He's been named as 53-year-old Jeffrey Johnson. The shooting was connected to a workplace dispute. A Norwegian court has found that Anders Behring Breivik was sane when he murdered 77 people in a gun and bomb massacre last year. He's been jailed for at least 21 years and faces the possibility of indefinite extensions to his sentence. More than 3,500 people fleeing the violence in Syria have entered Turkey over the past 24 hours, one of the highest daily refugee flows since the start of the uprising last year. It brings the number of Syrian refugees now sheltering in Turkey to more than 78,000. Talks between the United Nations nuclear watchdog and Iran, aimed at resolving concerns about Tehran's atomic program, have broken up without agreement. A senior UN official said no further talks were scheduled. The 7-time Tour de France champion Lance Armstrong has been stripped of his titles and banned from competitive cycling. He'd been given a midnight deadline last night to challenge the accusations against him, but in a statement posted on his website, he said there comes a point in every man's life when he has to say enough is enough. Buckingham Palace has announced that the Duke of Edinburgh will not be attending next Wednesday's Paralympics opening ceremony in London. The 91-year-old Duke is recovering from the bladder infection, which has just forced him to spend 5 nights in hospital. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. The time in London is 18:30 and you're listening to Midori House. Now, Vietnam has been seen as one of Asia's star economies, but now the nation's once lauded policies are attracting increasing concern. Two key bankers have been arrested this week as the feeling grows that the country can no longer balance the conflicting demands of its communist government and capitalist businessmen. And the stock markets have been stumbling. A little earlier, Andrew Tuck spoke to Catherine Barton, AFP's bureau chief in Hanoi. He started by asking her what's going on in the Vietnamese economy.
Well, the arrests are quite interesting because the first arrest, which was on Tuesday evening, was of one of Vietnam's wealthiest men and a very flamboyant, very high-profile tycoon who kind of owns football clubs and has been very much in the public eye. And he's seen, by experts as being quite close to the Prime Minister. And he's a founder of one of the country's largest private banks, the most successful private bank, which is 15% owned by Standard Charter. And since his kind of quite dramatic fall from grace, obviously there's been quite a lot of panic in Vietnam. And, over the last few days, depositors had been lining up to withdraw money from the Asia Commercial Bank, the bank that he founded, but is actually no longer directly involved with. And then yesterday evening, the former general director of the Asia Commercial Bank was also arrested for economic crimes. And that kind of really triggered a bit more panic. Although today, actually, the stock market has rallied slightly and the kind of run on deposits has slowed. So.
And what's the feeling that these are genuine cases, or is there a feeling that these are political cases, or do people in the street think this hints at some kind of corruption within the system?
I think very broadly seen as being they're political cases. I think there is a desire, certainly a lot of my sources have been saying that there is a desire on the part of the government to show that it's very serious about corruption and to send a message to the public that they take, corruption even at the highest level these tycoons very seriously. But I think, I think a lot of our sources are just saying really that you'd be dreaming if you thought this was a sign that the government are actually taking corruption seriously. It's much more that this kind of anti-corruption fight is a very convenient weapon within the internal kind of party feuding and factional, because it is quite a faction-driven party, some of our sources are saying.
In the introduction, we were hinting that, this does raise a very interesting question, especially because across the border you have another economy that's facing a similar kind of model, China, that this balancing of the kind of the communist government's policies and these incredibly rich tycoons, is there just something that means that there's bound to be these clashes when you're trying to run an economy with two conflicting ideas at its heart?
I think there is definitely a tension, and this is actually the second arrest of a major tycoon this year, or not arrest, sorry, but there was another very prominent parliamentarian, Madame Yen, who was also a kind of self-made multimillionaire, fell from grace. Now, I think it's difficult to put those two cases actually too closely because they were aligned with different factions, and I think it is much more about the party politics than about any particular move against this new generation of very wealthy tycoons. But I do think you're right that there is very much it's a very uneasy accommodation, and the party is still struggling to I think they've been almost less successful than in China with that, the way of kind of bringing in these businessmen and these very wealthy individuals into the party and finding a way to work with them.
And what have been the triggers so far for Vietnam actually until now being a successful economy? In the West we know that actually when we go to put our coats on or slip our shoes on that it often says made in Vietnam. But there's more to it than that, isn't there? There is a huge amount of resources potentially available to Vietnam off the coast. There's oil exploration going on. What helped Vietnam boom in the first place?
They've had obviously, they were very, very poor during the 1980s. And it was this initial opening up in the 1990s when the Communist Party first started this kind of deregulation and allowing, foreign companies back in, et cetera, which set off a first wave. But actually, more recently, they had a real wave of investment from about 2006, 2007 onwards, where a lot of kind of particularly East Asian investors were coming in and plowing a lot of money into, it is primarily factories, kind of low-end manufacturing. But that has basically, a lot of the growth you know, particularly more recently since the global economic crisis, has been fueled on kind of, you know, easy credit by the government and has been based around these state-owned enterprises, which the Prime Minister is seen, you know, quite as having very much promoted personally, along the kind of idea of like a South Korean model of having these very large, very successful, you know, state-run enterprises that will do it. But obviously that's just not worked, and you've had, you know, some very high-profile collapses of these state-owned enterprises, for example, the Vinalins and Vinashin, or these kind of shipping companies that have collapsed, and you've had various executives on trial, and there's an ongoing probe, and that kind of thing. And I think it is just, it's a model that, you know, now has almost, you know, a lot of experts are saying has basically run its course, and they need to either, if they want to continue with high rates of growth, they're going to need to do some serious reform, both of the, you know, the SOEs and also of the, particularly of the banking sector.
That was Catherine Barton speaking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck a little earlier. It's 18:37 here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth-largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com. The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the culture section this month, world-renowned war reporters and photographers reveal the contents of their kit bags before they gear up to ship off to the world's trouble spots. In Berlin, Y magazine opens up its editorial for military inspection. Gal Gadot's radio in Tel Aviv gets uniforms to spin hits. And we look at how Bollywood's dealing with India's military ambitions.
In the design section, we're granted access to Oscar Niemeyer's staggering Army Command headquarters in Brasilia. We also meet the tailor responsible for the most colourful military uniforms, those of the Swiss Guard in the Vatican City.
In the edit section, we take you to the Suomenlinna Sea Fortress in Helsinki in search of the best property deals. We also travel to Germany to see through the lens of the greatest binocular makers in the world.
The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. Now, here at Midori House, we frequently find that the answer to all of life's problems lies at the bottom of a cup of strong coffee. But surprisingly, not everyone agrees with us. In fact, across Europe, people are cutting back on their caffeine hits as the economic downturn continues to bite. So what will the consequences of this be? Aside from an increase in blurry-eyed employees lacking their usual spark in early morning meetings across the continent, will coffee producers stand to lose as much as the retailers and coffee shops? To answer this question, we're joined now by Mauricio Galindo Hurtado. He's an independent coffee markets consultant based in London. Mauricio, thank you very much for joining us. Could you maybe just tell us a little bit about what we're seeing here in terms of a lack of coffee drinking? Is it just that people aren't buying, or that people are buying cheaper, nasty stuff?
Yes, that's correct. What we're seeing is actually a shift in consumption. Overall, demand hasn't diminished, but what we're seeing is more in-home consumption as opposed to going out and drinking coffee in cafes. So, and this is a result of certainly the economic downturn and also increased prices that we had over the last year and a half.
And, I mean, Europe is actually the world's biggest consuming area of coffee. How sort of drastic is this decline? Is it something that is forcing coffee shops around Europe to close? Or is it really just sort of tiny little signs that maybe it's slowing down?
Not at all. Yeah, I wouldn't call it at all a catastrophic scenario. In fact, when you look at the figures, most coffee chains and certainly independent coffee retailers are doing extremely well. I think what we're seeing here is a shift in the market composition, where we see consumers buying more of the Robusta type of coffee, which is obviously put in evidence through much higher imports of Robusta, which is a lower quality, into Europe. And certainly there has been a decrease in Arabica imports, and that's not because people have decided to drink inferior quality out of simply a change in taste, but because prices for Arabica went so high and have come down markedly, although they're still relatively high according to historical levels. But I don't think we are seeing here like a dramatic decrease in consumption that could certainly impact producers in any way. In fact, the overall balance for coffee consumption versus production is actually quite tight at the moment.
And maybe we could talk a little bit about how coffee is consumed in Europe. So many people seem to wear it as a badge of honour that their country is the highest coffee drinking nation in Europe. I've heard definitely the Finns and the Danes stake that claim. But maybe you could finalise this once and for all. Which country does drink the most coffee in Europe?
It's certainly the Finns. They are consuming around 11 kilos per capita a year, which is a very, very high consumption. that means a lot of coffee, indeed. And they are followed by the Danes,
yes,
and the Swedes as well, who consume around an average 9 kilos a year, which is still very high. And then we would have the Germans, who are drinking on average 7 kilos, which is already quite a lot less, but still very high. And then we find more or less in the same level Spain, Italy, France, with about 5.5.
It's surprising that it's Northern European dominated, with the extreme coffee drinkers, if you will, when most people associate coffee and cafe culture very much with Southern Europe.
That's because what we think about when we think about coffee consumption in Southern Europe, we think about a cafe. We think about the Italian coffee bar in the morning having their ristretto and then going to work. Whereas Northern European countries have had a very strong at-home consumption, where filter coffee also means you use more coffee because, you know, you have your coffee machine at home. So it's more about how you drink it as opposed to how much of it you drink.
And if you could sort of project, maybe, I mean, you're a coffee markets expert, what the coffee scene will be like 10 years from now. Will every street be littered with independent cafes, or is it all going to be Starbucks, or will there be nothing at all? Will everybody just be drinking coffee at home?
I think what we're seeing is a very, very interesting route here, whereby a certain type of coffee, the specialty sector, the gourmet coffee, is certainly going to continue growing. In fact, growth has been spectacular. London is a fantastic place. It's actually, you know, I would say throughout Europe, there's no city where you find better coffee at the moment than London. This is due to all these independent micro-roasters who have definitely gone very far into their coffee hunting and are bringing in fantastic. So we're seeing that segment as continuing. There's increased knowledge, there's understanding of how important it is to know where you're coming from. But at the same time, of course, we'll have mainstream coffee that will still be the bulk of it, will be most of it Brazilian, which remains the biggest supplier and the one you can always rely on in terms of availability, just because of the sheer size and increases in productivity. So I think we'll have an increasingly differentiated market with a very expensive coffees on top for those who really want to invest in a high-quality product, and then a mainstream that is rather inelastic. I mean, people consume more of this, more of that, but overall, you really don't see decreases in consumption, actually, because of perhaps positive news on health and shifts in lifestyle. You see more coffee being consumed now than 10 years ago.
Mauricio Galindo Hurtado, a coffee markets consultant based in London. Thank you very much for joining us. Time for a little bit of music, maybe, to enjoy with your coffee. This is Young Starlet in the London scene, certainly, soon to go beyond London, I'm sure. This is Jessie Ware with Wildest Moments.
Look at me, the greatest.
That was Jessie Ware with Wildest Moments here on Midori House, where the time in London is 18:49.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, and Tokyoist. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντωστε καζίν, τέμα ον Μόνακο κοξικούμεντα νέδια.
Λόντον μπορ, έζε Μόνακο χωσανή.
Λόντζα δά, μπουρασε Μόνακο γερμιδάρτ.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Μόνακο κοξικούμεντα.
Τι Λόντρις, έσαι α Μόνακο 24.
Ο κυκίνινα τύρουνοα, Μόνακο 24.
Αυτό είναι το Μόνακο 24.
Vous écoutez Μόνακο 24.
Das ist Μόνακο 24.
Du listener for Μόνακο 24.
Κούντελετ Μόνακο 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Albert, yeah.
Now, everyone loves a parcel, but imagine having a parcel that's been lying unopened for 100 years. Well, that's what the people of Otta in Norway currently have in their possession, lucky things. The package was sealed in 1912 by the then mayor, Johan Nygaard, with the inscription reading, "Can open in 2012. It's actually been opened since we've been on air, and I'm joined now with such excitement by Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Tom, we've been crowding around our laptops with bated breath, waiting to watch live what this package does contain. Go on, reveal it for us.
Well, they say, Hugo, that the best things come to those who wait. And in this case, I feel we delivered on that adage in some respects, but perhaps not in others. Let me talk you through the package. At first, what happened within the package was a smaller package.
Brilliant.
So it was following that kind
just
of
a big,
Russian
long historical game of parcel.
Exactly, the sort of Russian doll excitement began to build until we got to, you know, the interior package.
Okay, how many packages did we get
there
through?
There were a number, sort of two to get to that stage.
Fine.
Now, there were a number of sort of lengths of fabric, some in the colour of the Norwegian flag.
Right.
One emblazoned with the legend, "From the King."
Okay, so,
gosh, fairly
okay,
exciting, so yes, at that stage. And then one of the other package openers continued to sort of rummage through. There were notebooks, some newspaper cuttings, letters.
Oh, boring.
A drawing, some council papers.
Oh, no.
Fairly
I was
exciting.
Really hoping it was going to be something fairy tale in there.
And
fairies or something.
And various other ephemera, can okay. I describe it as?
Artifacts to be popped in a cage.
Well, exactly, exactly.
Or a case for a museum.
So, one couldn't describe it as thrilling.
No. But did everybody have, like, mock excitement that, oh, my goodness, we've got more notebooks?
Well, it was interesting that the,
never have enough notebooks.
One of the directors of the museum after the opening was asked, you know, what her verdict was. And she said, "To us museum folks, this is like gold."
Oh.
So it's obviously exciting if you have that fascination with,
I know, I
feel archive
very,
materials.
Yeah, churlish for having said boring, because actually it will be fascinating historical artifacts. And the people of the Gudbrandsdal Museum will be poring over these things for months to come, presumably.
Well, that's the thing.
Source material.
This is the thing. And the mayor of Sel, Dag Erik Prien, suggested that whilst they wouldn't be, you know, financially better off, Their history was a lot richer on this momentous day. Which I think it's rather beautifully
clear. Line had been rehearsed, perhaps, do you think?
Possibly. I think in expectation that this was going to be something of an anticlimax.
Because I have to say, when I first heard about this story, I thought, oh my God, like some nutcase has dug out a parcel from their attic. But actually, it's a very big story. And I think it was opened in the presence of the princess, wasn't it?
There was a grand piano there. I mean, there was a lot of excitement. Obviously, I think some of the rumours had got people rather more excited. There were suggestions that the famous Blue Star Diamond that was lost when the Titanic sank, obviously in 1912, this
of
symbolic
course.
Year, could have, you know, lain within this package, which would have been most exciting.
Oh my God! Was James Cameron there?
I'm sure he was. I'm sure he was looking on from somewhere.
Kate Winslet was in the wings.
Exactly. But municipal papers, Blue Star Diamond.
Yeah, I like the
not quite.
One Norwegian schoolchild hoped that there might be a pea in there.
If there'd been some, you know, general vegetation, that might have been more compelling.
Don't. Okay, well, we're going to have to wait maybe a few days, weeks, perhaps even months to work out exactly what the historical significance is of this mystery package. But people in Norway will be going to bed a little the wiser as to what it contains.
I think so. And it's also worth bearing in mind that this unveiling was on coincided with the 400th celebration of a battle of the townspeople of Otter, who defeated some Scottish soldiers hired by Sweden.
Dear.
So the symbolism is
it's
also very rich on this day.
It could have been more disappointing than notebooks and civil papers and things. There could have just been some chewing gum in there, which leads me to my next song, which is sung by one of our Norwegian popstresses. This is Annie with Chewing Gum. Was Chewing Gum by Annie. The time in London is 1855. You're listening to Midori House. And we've got another guest in here now. This is our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who is fresh from an Asian whirlwind tour.
And other points in between.
Other points in between?
Don't you recall? We were in Sweden.
Oh, gosh. Of course we were.
It's the same trip. It's the same outfit as well. I've never been more thrilled to... I mean, 3 weeks is a long time on the road for me. And when I got home this morning, I was like, oh, thank God, I can park this suitcase. But then I was too lazy to actually... jump into my wardrobe. I was so comfortable with these clothes that I just went and found something clean in my suitcase.
You've been wearing the same shirt for 3 weeks?
Pretty much. I was actually wondering how many times it's been laundered.
Oh, okay. So you can do laundry in the meantime.
Oh, come on. I think you can do laundry on the road as well. Why are you looking so tanned?
Oh, this is still the remnants of Sweden.
It
actually.
Is.
Yeah. And also I was in Portugal.
That's right.
In between two. But you are here because you are going to be co-hosting tonight's...
I'm here to be with you, but yes, I am. I'm with the lovely, lovely Emma Nelson this evening.
And she gives a good show.
She gives a great show. I think Mr. Mueller is somewhere out in the middle of the Atlantic, I believe. I think we sent him to the Azores.
We have. We've had to split them up for a little bit.
Hopefully people can connect the dots. There's a bit of a Portuguese Lusophonia theme going on. So anyway, I will be sitting in almost 3 hours from now. I will be in your seat and I'm doing the daily with Emma Nelson tonight.
And tell us what we have to look forward to.
Tonight, we are going to be talking about the West's options with Syria, and we're going to be exploring exactly what might happen, what plans are being drawn up. We've obviously read a lot this week about a little bit of saber rattling in terms of what might happen if Syria uses chemical weapons. So we'll be talking about what plans are being drawn up by various forces. We're going to be talking to our Sasha Eisenberg, so we're going to have a bit of a good evening with the Americas. We're talking about the Republican convention, so he'll be live with us this evening. And a little bit earlier, I already did a piece with our Poppy Shibamoto, our photo director, and our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. We were talking about the demise of Kodak, which is just so incredibly sad. And it was interesting when I was in Japan a couple of weeks ago. It was amazing to see that one company who probably were actually making the old Kodak film boxes for large format are now selling them because it was such a great storage device for people. I mean, you look in so many people's apartments and people have got these large format Kodak boxes. I mean, we still have a few of them around. Yeah. So we'll be talking. It was a great interview, just chatting to them about what they thought of the Kodak brand and what they could do to revive themselves.
Well, heaps to look forward to on that.
Absolutely.
That comes at 2200 hours London time. That's the Monocle Daily with Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. But that's all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. The producer was Hannah Jenkins. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Stay tuned, because coming up next after the news headlines with Barney Burnham is this week's brand new episode of The Menu. Emma Nelson, Tyler Brulé will be back, as I've said, at 2200 hours with the Monocle Daily. But for now, from here at Midori House, it's time to say goodbye. Thank you.